Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Marcus Mabry is with us now, New York Times editor-at-large and former international business editor. He's been writing some of the most interesting articles on South Africa since the death of Nelson Mandela, like about young South Africans and what they call the Mandela generation, ironically, or the born free generation, also about social mobility there, with some references to how it compares to here. And his article Saturday headlined, "Gay South Africans Worry Now That Mandela Is Gone." Hi, Marcus. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Good to be here.
So to begin with the most recent, gay South Africans worry now that Mandela was gone. Was he anything of a gay rights activist?
Mandela was absolutely a gay rights activist. You know, it really reminds me a lot of Coretta Scott King here in the U.S., who also was a gay rights activist in the end of her life and her career. Both of them look to the kind of, especially, let me stick with the ANC example. Mandela in the ANC was committed to gay rights early on in the liberation struggle when they made allies of communists and of other leftists, but also of lesbian and gay activists. And they did it because they felt civil rights had to apply to everyone in South Africa. So it was a very, very long-standing commitment on the part of the ANC. And when they came to power, much in the same way, Mandela refused to turn his back on former allies like Cuba and like Angola. He also, at the same time, said that we're going to honor our commitment to gay rights. And so gay marriage was always, equal rights for gays and lesbians, and gay marriage as a result of that was always an ANC principle from the very beginning of the new South Africa.
We've been hearing so much about gay rights in India after that Supreme Court ruling there reinstating a decade in prison as permissible punishment just for gay sex. Where does South Africa fall today on the gay rights spectrum?
It falls incredibly pro is where it falls today. There is an openly gay Supreme Court justice on the South African Supreme Court, something that I think who happens to be a good friend of mine from my time there in South Africa as a reporter, but something I think would be hard to imagine on the U.S. Supreme Court. Right now, maybe soon, but certainly not today. And gay rights are legal there. Gay adoption, gay marriage, those are all legal things in South Africa. I've gotten some flame out on I've gotten flamed a little on Twitter for our piece because it really is a video piece about one multiracial gay family. One dad is white, one dad is mixed race, or what the South Africans call colored, and their adopted son, their baby, is. His mom is mixed race, and his dad was either mixed race or black. No one really knows. But some people on Twitter were upset that I did a video saying that, you know, these people are worried, but that doesn't mean that everyone's worried or everyone should worry. And it certainly is true that not everyone is worried. It's one of those stories where we've been looking at South Africa and the evolving South Africa and all the different issues that different South Africans feel as Mandela fades away from the scene, as he is literally gone from South Africa. What will it mean for them? And so it was one impressionistic slice of one family's mm-hmm. concerns. But certainly, yeah, there are a lot of people who worry, and lots of gay rights activists have been concerned in particular with this Supreme Court justice that was appointed by President Zuma and feeling that he was not a gay rights advocate himself.
And your article on social mobility last week had quotes and descriptions of people worrying about whether South Africa's relative racial comity will last long past Mandela's death, since he was so focused more than others on reconciliation without bitterness about the past. How much did Mandela's own high standards set the tone for the attitudes and the politics, even as he was long out of leadership into his 80s and 90s?
You know, Brian, that's the key question, and I think it's and no one can actually answer it because we won't know until now that he's gone, and it may take a year or so to really feel what it means, what his absence means. But his presence, you really saw what it meant when you talked to South Africans once it was clear his illness was going to likely take his life, and they had to psychologically deal with the fact that Mandela was going to die soon. They came together in a way they had not come together, well actually ever. Because if you were there after the end of apartheid and the beginning of the new South Africa, there was still profound worry, profound distress, profound fear on the part of everyone, really, but especially white South Africans. Now, almost 15 years later, that's all gone. There was this unity about Mandela and the memory of Mandela, and this was even before he was dead, the importance of Mandela that cut across an emotional admiration and feeling that Mandela was a personal inspiration in their own lives that cut across class, race, political affiliation, something I had never, ever seen in South Africa or, frankly, in any country. And that we cannot overestimate how strong that was. We do not know what its political import will be until now. Now that it's going to be gone, we'll find out.
And I've never been to South Africa, but I've always found their national story so compelling and with its similarities to our own. I mean, we can hardly credit Mandela and his peers enough, I think, for ending this brutal minority rule that was apartheid with truth and reconciliation as a core value, despite all their very real problems that are ongoing, rather than the revenge wars that we've seen in the Balkans after their authoritarian rule cracked and now in parts of the Arab world. Was it Mandela? Was it Bishop Tutu? Was it something more deeply ingrained in the black majority character in that particular country than just being led by these few enlightened leaders? Is there any way to say?
I'm going to say it was all that, and even more than that. I think it also, in less poetic terms, I think it was also the economic and business interest of the white elite of apartheid. I think it was those companies and those billionaires realizing that in order for their private and personal fortunes to continue to grow, South Africa had to rejoin the world community. And in order to do that, it had to get rid of apartheid. They really pushed the ruling National Party into the negotiating table. But I think Tutu and Mandela were key. You know, Tutu has this amazing thing, and I think it's important these days to remember it, that he said to me when I said, well, lots of victims of apartheid and its violence were not satisfied with the truth and reconciliation process. Because what it meant was, if you were someone who had done crime, had killed someone, killed many people, all you had to do was say, and I shouldn't say all, but what you had to do was, as it were, confess to your crimes, admit them all, give the details, so that the victims' families could have details of what had happened to their loved one, because many of them, hundreds or thousands, had no idea what had happened. They just disappeared and never came home. So they could, if you told it all, then you were actually freed from prosecution. You were freed from going to jail, doing one day or one day more, depending on your circumstance, of jail time. And that was not, that certainly, that's not fulfilling to everyone. And Tutu said it certainly is not fulfilling to everyone. But what we have to remember in South Africa was that we didn't win. The forces of freedom and democracy did not win. This was a truce. And in a truce, you take what you can get. And both sides did that. There was no victory here. And that's kind of hard. But that was the reality of the new South Africa. That was the reality that Nelson Mandela had to sell to the world and to his people. And he thought that it was much preferable to any kind of a score settling. That in the end, maybe there would be some vengeance would lead to some greater sense of satisfaction on the part of someone or some population or some group, but that would in the end be the end of South Africa. And he understood that. And he did all he could to take his own personal bitterness and pain, because he did indeed have those things, and hide them completely from the rest of the world. It was an amazing thing.
Listeners, any calls for New York Times editor-at-large Marcus Mabry, who's been writing some of the really interesting pieces about South Africa after Nelson Mandela, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. You mentioned the current president, Jacob Zuma, and, you know, if it weren't for the fake sign language interpreter, maybe the moment we'd all be talking about in this week leading up to Mandela's burial yesterday was the one where Zuma was actually booed by the crowd. Did you catch that moment?
I certainly did. On one hand, you have to feel for Jacob Zuma. On the other hand, you don't. Look, Zuma is no Mandela. He was never Mandela. Many would argue he's not even an Mbeki. And by that, I mean Thabo Mbeki, the Mandela's successor as the president of South Africa, who Zuma,
succeeded.
Zuma's rise was thanks to Mbeki's fall. There was an interim between the two. But at any rate, you know, he's I don't even know how to the booing to me summed up two things. On the one hand, we talked about the Born Frees a little bit. The Born Free generation, they both kind of they split off into largely black South Africans who are middle class, who actually represent a kind of a breed of South African that did not even exist when I was based there 14 years ago. And these are middle class and upper middle class, incredibly well educated young people who are black. And there's a critical mass of them. They didn't exist a generation ago. They are the Born Frees. They are a result of Mandela and the struggle. At the same time, they distance themselves from the ANC because they feel like, well, okay, that's all done now. You gave us freedom, and we are thankful for that. Okay, what have you done for us lately? The new challenges are not about freedom or apartheid. They're about very different things. So what is the ANC offering to get us toward the future? Now, that's the upper middle class right. and the middle class Born Frees. Then there are the working class and the poor Born Frees, who are a much, much larger population, still the mass of South Africans. And they are becoming less patient. They didn't struggle through the worst of apartheid. And so they say, well, where are the jobs? Where is the educational opportunity? Where is the equal education in the townships and in the rural areas? And they say white people, and there's some logic to this, they say white people have actually done better since the end of apartheid as far as, say, economic increases in their salaries and stuff than blacks have. And so they tire of the ANC not delivering more.
And some of the stats on that I got from your article, you point out that average annual incomes of black-led households almost tripled from 2001 to 2011. And yet in recent years, the gap between blacks and whites has actually worsened, whereby in 2001, white-led households typically earned close to $17,000 more than their black counterparts at current exchange rates. But by 2011, that disparity had grown to nearly $30,000. So that's not going to make for, a lot of peace and reconciliation.
No, and hence the boos from the people who were in that stadium.
And also regarding Zuma, and I guess this plays into the boos, tell me, he's got the scandal, right, over construction at his private home, which used public funds to build things like a swimming pool and an outdoor amphitheater for himself.
Yes, and there's also, you know, better roads there than anywhere else, you know, in the surrounding area. And all these problems, these are things that both black South Africans, but also white South Africans, and in some ways, especially white South Africans, look to and say, well, you're doing exactly what other kleptocrats have done elsewhere on the continent, and you seem to be more prone to the Africa disease, which is a horrible, and I think unfair phrase to use, the Africa disease of corruption than, say, a Mandela was or than Mbeki was. And that's unfortunate, because if that impression were to set in, either at home, but even especially abroad, where South Africa still depends greatly on foreign investment, that would be very, very bad for South Africa. You're not going to be able to raise up the mass of still impoverished South Africans without foreign capital and faith and confidence in the country. And if there's a sense that corruption is set in from the very top and is pervading the system, then that would be the worst thing, I think, that could happen to the new South Africa post-Mandela.
Tom in Kingston, you're on WNYC with Marcus
Hello.
Mabry. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Sir, what I'd like to ask you is, what could we learn in America about how we relate to each other, how we deal with the race issue from South Africa's history? And I'll just mention one critique I've heard of the civil rights movement here that has been compelling to me was around it being too much of a leader-based movement. And that's why there wasn't transformation more of towns and people's hearts and minds. But basically what I want you to address and mention is anything you could find helpful on a personal level, on a political level, on an activism level, what Americans could learn from the past, 30 years of South African history?
That's a huge question, Marcus. And in countries that have parallels but are also so different from each other.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly have to. Certainly, leaders matter in South Africa too. As we, you know, extol Mandela, who is probably the most. It was amazing to be there in the summer when we thought he first was going to pass away, because this was kind of, and even in this funeral we saw last week, the memorial service with more heads of state present than any other event in the history of humanity.
That was unbelievable. So that was like better than the UN.
This was amazing. This is a man who translates universally. So obviously that leader meant a great deal, right? More than any other leader of the American Civil Rights Movement, even.
And I don't want to diminish. I know what Tom said, but I don't also want to diminish the mass movement aspect of the civil rights movement in the United States and write it off as too leader driven either.
That's true. So there are these things, as we all know, these things are all complicated. The examples, and Brian, as you said, there are certainly imperfect comparisons between these two nations. I mean, the biggest one to me, as an African American, born and raised in this country, was that the numbers are flipped, the proportions. And so South Africa is an overwhelmingly black country, something like 80% or more, and this country is still the opposite. You know, about 75 now, is it, of white versus non-white.
Yeah.
So as we go today, when America is more equal to white, and between white and non-white, we're still right now pretty close to what South Africa is, but it's reversed. And I think that difference makes a huge difference. It's much easier, number one, to have the success that they had economically when you have this massive kind of underpaid black, almost indentured servitude class. A majority. That's much easier to pull off an economic miracle than when we had what we had, all right? So it's kind of almost as if slavery were to have continued forever in the U.S. And, wow, what an economic miracle it would have been, but not nearly as big as South Africa's was. So I think that made a big difference to me in terms of reconciliation. The fact you have a majority of black people, a minority of white people who are well off. And so even poor white folks are still much better off than your average black South African. So that allows a certain security, as it were, on the part of the white South African, so they were not nearly as intimidated because they have economic freedom. You could argue they could be more intimidated because they have greater black masses, but the way South Africa is constructed, those masses don't usually pose a threat, and crime is actually, decrease in freedom because they have such armed response there, as many guns as we have here, and actually probably less gun violence, ironically, than here. But at any rate, I think the lessons I would draw personally and in terms of activism, I think, is the importance of the individual contact. That is certainly in South Africa across racial lines. The most successful activists there and activism there and activist organizations there, including the ANC, were the ones that were multiracial. There were some that were actually much more kind of all black or all white, and those were much, 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 much less successful and are kind of falling apart at this point. So it was that personal contact of not just being an activist and having certain ideals, but establishing personal relationships across the lines.
Although, I'll highlight a survey. And we're going to run out of time in a minute, that I should say you highlight a survey in your article that shows less than 40% of South Africans socialized with people of another race. But did you know there was a Reuters poll here in the U.S. last year that asked the same question? Want to guess what percentage of white Americans say they don't socialize with someone of the other race?
I think it's something like, isn't it something like 85%?
Nope, but it was also 40%. So the fact that those numbers lined up so close was pretty interesting.
Maybe I'm thinking about school and living. I mean, that's what I'm thinking about.
School and living?
Because from school situations to living situations, we are a deeply segregated society in America still. And I think that provides our greatest hurdle. Because even if idealistically we believe in certain values like integration and equality, if we're not actually sharing spaces together, and New York is we're kind of lucky in New York where we don't really have a choice. We're all on top of each other. There's greater cross-pollination here than in most American cities. And obviously more than most American suburbs.
Indeed. And you know what? As a little preview, that's going to come up in about 10 minutes in our Reasons to Love New York segment that we're going to do with New York Magazine, which has that special issue out this week. And one of the things that somebody wrote into us certainly has to do with all the diversity on the subways that you can't avoid, even if you wanted to. So Marcus Mabry, editor-at-large for the New York Times. Thanks for writing so interestingly and coming on to talk so interestingly about South Africa around the death of Nelson Mandela. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.